call to order the February 16th, 2010 meeting of the Sussex County Council. Approval of the agenda. Mr. Baker, have you any changes today?
Yes. First, under myself, emergency operations plan, request for proposals. We'd like to defer on that. We have a couple more items to finalize on that. And then the executive session, we will not need today.
Council have anything? Not to entertain a motion to approve the agenda as amended?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Motion carries. In your packets this week were the February 2nd minutes. Were there any changes?
I need to change the attorney. I have made an error, so I'll take care of that.
Okay. And what is that change, Ms.?
It should First be page. Everett Moore.
Okay. With that change, if there are no other comments, I'll accept those minutes as approved. Reading of correspondence, Mr. Moore?
Yes, Mr. President. I have one letter from Junior Achievement to David Baker. Dear Mr. Baker, I'm personally touched by the generosity you have demonstrated through your gift of $1,000 to Junior Achievement of Delaware. It is our vision that Junior Achievement of Delaware be the partner of choice for businesses, educators, and policymakers seeking to expand workforce and economic development via youth development. This will be accomplished one student at a time through structured interactions with caring adults on the topics of work readiness, entrepreneurship, and financial literacy. At no other time has the story and vision of Junior Achievement been more compelling or important. Thank you for being a vital part of our success story. Rob Epps, President. That's it, Mr. President.
Does Council have any correspondence? If not, we'll turn the meeting over to Mr. Baker, our County Administrator.
Good morning. Thank you. The first item is a storm report, and with us this morning, we have three members of the Emergency Operations Center staff, Ricky Short, Debbie Jones, and Chip Stevenson. I don't know if they'd like to come up. But I thought I'd just like to highlight some of the items regarding the two back-to-back storms that occurred last week. First, there was we had a coordinated response, which was staged at our active EOC from Friday, February 5th, to February 13th, Saturday, for the two events. We had basically two major problems during the storm. The first was power outages, and then during the second storm, stranded motorists. During the first storm, there were major power outages in the county. On the 6th, February 6th, there were between 40 and 50,000 without electric. On the 7th, between 17 and 30,000. On the 8th, 13,000 roughly. And on the 9th, about 1,200. There were many calls taken at the EOC for those without power. With the 2 foot of snow, strong winds, freezing temperature, the county fire service, police, towns, farmers, and others responded. The National Guard became, in many cases, the only viable means of transportation given the large amounts of snow and cold weather. Five sets of Del Dot plows and guard vehicles were worked from the county EOC in Georgetown. Many were rescued with these vehicles and taken to shelters, relatives, and friends. Over 100 were staying at three Red Cross shelters at one point. The Guard also transported people for dialysis, prescriptions that were needed as an emergency, and then, of course, senior citizens without heat. The second storm brought a different challenge. We did not have the anticipated power outage problems like the first storm. But on the day of the second storm, a blinding blizzard stranded many motorists throughout the county. Main routes were blocked, like Route 24, with stranded cars. The EOC received many cell phone calls from stranded motorists stuck in their cold cars. Guard vehicles, again, were paired with a snowplow from Del Dot and a policeman. They worked all night and picked up over 100 stranded motorists. Del Dot plows were paired with ambulances also in the fire service. The fire service handled all the calls it could with their equipment. Many other problems arose during the storms, including building collapses, trees down, wires down, fires, etc. We would like to thank the residents of Sussex County who patiently waited hours and days for their electric to come back on. They improvised by melting snow and using wood stoves and kerosene heaters and helping their neighbors. We'd also like to thank the many public safety providers, the fire service, the police, the towns, the Delaware National Guard, paramedics, our EOC staff, our buildings and grounds staff, security guards. We had one security guard who was here 36 hours in this building. And many staff who volunteered to help out with the storm. And we'd like to more properly thank some of the many who helped at a future county council meeting.
Okay.
And I would like to, there are three, Ricky, Debbie, and Chip were there practically the entire week. Were you there the whole week, Ricky, or did you go home at all?
We all got like one night off.
One night off. And I know Joe is off today, but he went home one night during the entire week, and they really, everybody stepped up, and Bobby Schoonover was there and did a lot of work also, of course. We have many other county employees who came in and helped as call takers and actually ended up being stuck at the UC because they couldn't get home, so they ended up spending a lot more time there than they anticipated. And we sincerely appreciate all their efforts.
And the new building does have a place for them to sleep. Right, doesn't it?
Yes, the National Guard supplied us some cots, and we used one of the rooms for a sleeping area with cots. Also, the room that is set up for each agency to have a seat, that was fully utilized during the week. It really, normally for a northeaster or flooding event, we don't have to use that, there's limited use of that room. But we had roughly, I'd say, 20 or 25 people from all the different agencies there. And when the call would come in, you could go right, if it was a DLDOT concern or a National Guard concern or co-op, mm-hmm. you could go right to that person and say, here it is. You take care of it. Great. Instead of trying to find, locate them by telephone somewhere. So it really, I think it really proved its worth mm-hmm. during the storm. And I don't think the building really felt real crowded at any point in time, which was...
Not like the old one.
Like the old one did, or would have, for sure. So,
I would again, like to thank Mr. Baker. It's just incredible the amount of time that he put in, and the buck always seemed to stop with Mr. Baker on
yes,
so many
it does.
Issues. And certainly Joe Thomas was right there by his side, but... Again, thank you, Mr. Baker, for your dedication. We are very fortunate to have you at the helm. Also, would like to point out that I've gotten a number of calls from folks that were on our press release list. Our public information officer has expanded who gets those press releases, and a number of folks called and said that they felt the line of communication coming from the county was even better than those agencies up the chain, DEMA and what have you.
Does he ever take any time off, Mr. President, that public information officer?
Yeah.
Never stop.
Okay, all right.
Oh, my.
You pushed it, Chip. You pushed it.
You are pushing that a little far.
Just couldn't take it. Mr. Baker, are you... Now, as the dust has settled, or maybe the snow has settled, have you any thoughts on areas that you want to focus on for future improvement? I mean, it was something unprecedented, but I'm sure there's been observations that you've made in the last 2 weeks that could help us.
What we'd like to do is get together with some of the different agencies and talk about some of the things we could do better in the future and how we could better prepare. And, there's some small things. For instance, the number of cots was one thing, there are some probably bigger issues. We kind of learned as time went. For instance, during the first storm, we didn't have enough people from the Delaware National Guard at the center to handle the number of calls that all of a sudden came in with all the electric outages. And they were kind of backed up because they were trying to we have one individual from the Guard trying to handle all these calls and dispatch and get approvals and whatnot. So Eventually, we had three people from the guard right there in the center to help organize that. There were a number of different things we had in mind, but we are definitely going to get together and with with the various organizations and try to follow up on some of these areas that we can improve.
Dave, I know that some of these new fire halls have actually, you know, bunk areas set up permanently, you know, for emergencies and stuff. We don't have that at our EOC at this point, right?
No, but we do have a locker room with showers, of course, and
is there a room that we could set up, you know, just a minimal amount of maybe beds that would be there that would be fairly comfortable as opposed to some of these army cots and stuff?
Well, there is one room that we used for the cots that I presume, you know, was talk of using air mattresses instead of cots, and, you know, that would
We ought to make it, you know, we ought to have some basic accommodation. Then if we need more, you can bring in some of the air mattresses. But I was just thinking if something permanently set up might be advantageous.
We use the training room, which they do use for other purposes, normally for meetings. But that was set up with the cots. And actually, I think it worked out pretty well.
Mm-hmm. And do we have cots there, or do we have to go ask for...
Well, we borrowed them. We're going to either purchase our own cots or air mattresses, something for the future.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So, we ought to be somewhat prepared.
We borrowed them from the guard
this
time.
We're going to need that type of service out there.
Yeah. That was one of the concerns we had, and Mr. Short has put together a list of local farmers who have expressed interest in helping, and we're going to try to maintain that list on a regular basis, so that we'll have that ready to go and can actually call on, you know, if there's someone in the Bridgeville area, for instance, we know we have someone listed and can help the fire service or whomever.
It almost seemed as if the first storm was all about the electric outages, but the real moment of crisis may have come in the second storm with the stranded vehicles. And I remember when you called me, I guess it was Wednesday night at 8 o'clock, suggesting that we needed to put out the call because there was such a level of crisis. And I was thinking to myself, my goodness, 8 o'clock at night, what a waste of time, but you got Chip on it and the word got out pretty quick, and I found out the next morning you had 16 farmers who stepped up at that late hour and volunteered to be on call. It's just incredible.
I have a question. I got a lot of calls about secondary roads that weren't plowed out. So in order to access some of these farmers that want to help, would I be telling people to call EOC?
Yes, that's fine. Mm-hmm. We will have that list for the future, mm-hmm. and we'll regularly update that list. So
okay.
that's one of the changes that we'll... Now, some farmers, of course, like Mr. Wilson, for instance, were out on their own helping individuals in need, and that was certainly very much appreciated. And
he's a county employee, isn't he?
He should be
out there.
I bet my mileage, George. I get any mileage out of your
car. You have to submit it, and then we'll vote on it, Sam.
Got some TV coverage, too. That looked good.
That's what he wanted.
He let the girl drive his front end loader, the TV reporter.
Hope you got good insurance.
You're the one need that, George. You're running this year.
I don't know how to drive heavy equipment.
All right. Mr. Vincent, anything from the fire company's perspective you'd like to share?
No, just I think that, you know, Dave's right, that the people at the EOC, the three that are here, but everybody out there did a tremendous job. It was certainly taxing at times, a lot of more calls than we had people to deal with things sometimes. But the conditions out there were not the best in the world. But it was a good job done by those people, and I'm sure at some point in time we will recognize them and thank them. In some kind of special way, because it was. There were some things that showed up, I think, that we can talk about and do better at next time.
Yes.
Union job.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Union job.
Anything else, Mr. Baker?
No, not on that one, but I do have an item for legislative update.
Okay.
Mr. Pat Emery from Department of Natural Resources was here, and he suggested that we... Mr. Emery suggested is that the counties, all three counties, consider endorsing legislation that they have proposed, and there's two bills. One is a housekeeping type proposal to consolidate in Title IX, which covers county responsibilities, certain dog control responsibilities that have already been transferred to the counties. These responsibilities are noted now in Title VII, and this would help better define in Title IX where those responsibilities should be. This legislation is being reviewed by the county attorney and staff, and I think in theory the staff is in support of the change because it would simplify the legal record, but there will be some changes, I think, that we would suggest in that piece of legislation. The second bill is basically the same, except that it adds a responsibility to the counties, and that is regarding dangerous dogs. And in the proposed legislation on pages 15 and 16, there's a definition, which I believe is the current definition of what a dangerous or potentially dangerous dog is. And there's different items on 16. For instance, if the dog chased or pursued a person in apparent attack mode on two separate occasions within 12 months, or killed or physically injured a human being or a domestic animal, or subject to animal cruelty or animal fighting, criminal complaints. And basically, if that's the case, then the dog would be impounded by a dog control agency, which I believe now is the Delaware SPCA. If the owner cannot be identified within 5 days of the impoundment, then the animal control agency may dispose of the dog in accordance with Chapter 80. If the owner is found, then the owner would be notified and with a notice that would require the owner return within 7 days of receiving such a notice, a signed statement indicate whether the owner wishes a hearing to be conducted or the owner waives the right and agrees to abide by the findings of the animal control agency. So if there is a hearing, then there's a 21-day wait, and then the hearing would be scheduled by a panel of dog control panel of 5 members, which is currently in place. With the legislation, each county would select an individual to serve on a panel to select members of the panel. So, anyway, that would require a majority vote. There would be one representative from each county, but there would be a veterinarian. There is a veterinarian, an animal club member, an animal behaviorist, and so on, police officer that would be on that panel. So, there is, according to Mr. Emery, the cost that the state incurs now for the dog control panel, which is a volunteer panel, is roughly $400 to $500 for a transcript for the hearing. We did ask Mr. Moore to look at that as to whether or not that was necessary. Mr. Moore indicated that it was not necessary.
Yep. Mr. President, if I may, many times on hearings, they're often just simply taped, and then if someone appeals that hearing, it would be their obligation to pay for a transcript on appeal as opposed to it being a county's obligation. I would suggest that any legislation have that type language in, that it would simply be taped hearings electronically, and then if someone appealed, they could then pay for the transcript themselves, as happens many other cases. Even here in our zoning hearings are handled that way.
Understood. Is there anything in here about noisy dogs? Because that's what you get most of the calls about. Mm-hmm. And once everybody realizes the county's now in dog control, we're going to get the calls for the people who've got the yappy dogs that never stop, you know, bark all night. Is there anything in this bill, Dave? No, there isn't, is there? That's we get more complaints about that than I think anything else. Is there a way to address that? Do any other jurisdictions address noisy dogs?
I'm sure some do.
Nuisance dogs?
We haven't. We don't address it, as you're aware, and I'm not aware of any state requirement or legislation regarding that or rules. If you'd like to come on up. Basically, the county council's decision is whether or not to support the legislation with or without the dog, the dangerous dog portion of the legislation. Basically, our dog control responsibilities, of course, licensing and stray dogs. And when the original legislation was approved, the counties were told that the cruelty issues and dangerous dog issues would stay with the state. The AG's office has agreed to continue to prosecute, and that was one suggestion by Mr. Moore that he, in either whichever part of this legislation that the county would agree to, we could add into that a requirement that the AG's office continue to prosecute, which they have agreed to do by policy.
Mm-hmm.
So that would pretty much firm that up. But basically, it's a question of whether or not to support the legislation without the dog dangerous dog responsibility and add the requirement for the AG's office to handle prosecution, or to support it with the dangerous dog responsibility, which is actually handled by the animal control agencies.
Well, good morning.
Good morning.
I haven't had time to read this, I admit. I think we got it in our packets on Saturday, and I'm just still digging out, really. So unless the council really wants to vote on this today, mm-hmm. I'm hoping that we can
support it or not, correct?
Is there a deadline?
Which I would prefer to read it before I vote.
Right, I'm just saying that's all the vote is, right?
It mm-hmm. does remind me, just looking at it, as a lot of strings that we have to follow, even though we're now responsible for paying for all of this. Is there a case to be made that maybe we should be given a lot more flexibility in the construction of the regulation?
The way the statute's set up, Mr. President, it seems to be a lot more complicated than it really is. A lot of the transfer should have been taking place the last go-around. For some unknown reason, the actual nut of the whole thing is dogs running at large, and for some reason it was left out the last transfer. Now, the Attorney General's office worked on the transfer in conjunction with a couple people in my shop. I probably should have played a bigger role in it and monitoring myself, but I thought we had everything in line, and needless to say, we didn't. So it looks much more complicated than it really is. The only difference is that you're basically doing all the animal control things in a nutshell, with the exception of dangerous dogs. This, what it's doing is it's transferring that authority from Title VII and putting it in Title IX. It makes much better sense, because that way we won't have dog control split in two different titles. Somebody's trying to find something, it's all under one roof, so to speak. The dangerous dog, originally when we had discussed this, we had talked about keeping dangerous dog because we thought it might be a problem with the counties. And when we looked it over, we concluded it would probably best to go to the counties because there's no funding source through the state to handle the dangerous dog issues. Currently, we handle it through our shop, and we were allowed through epilogue language originally to have $50,000 of the proceeds associated with dog operations for coming off the license fees. For that type of thing, the rest of it rolled back into the operation itself. Epilogue language last year brought that down to $25,000, and in many cases we didn't expend that kind of money to begin with. But with dangerous dogs being the way it is set up right now, we're going to end up in a situation where we don't have any money allocated to even take care of dangerous dogs. The dangerous dog, the main crutch of the whole thing is the administration of it. I've talked to Murray, who's your contractor through Ken SPCA. He has no problem administering this. It's relatively simple, just a matter of setting up the times and that type of thing. That's what one of our girls did. The other part of it was the court stenographer, and I think Mr. Moore addressed that to some degree, and that would probably be happy with. I'd be happy to work it that way. That's what originally it was done. But we had a case transferred to CCP at one point in time, and with that case transfer, the judge couldn't understand the tape. The quality of the tape wasn't that good, and the whole thing had to be thrown out. And that's the reason why we went with court stenographers. It's averaging somewhere in the neighborhood around $400 each time. Now, I think Mr. Baker probably told you this, and I got a list of last year's, let me get it out of here.
I didn't mention that.
Yeah, last year's SPC, I don't know if he gave you this a copy in your packet or not, but the number of appeals that we had, apparently were 21 dangerous dog hearings statewide. Of the 21s are request-wise. Of the 21, there are 17 actual hearings scheduled. Three of them were later canceled. So actually, we only had 14 dangerous dog hearings or panels statewide. And they're broken down in counties. The vast majority of them are Newcastle and Wilmington. Sussex County had one.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a tremendous amount of money. Now, what I want you to be aware of, the fact is you'll be getting some money back from us here in the not-too-distant future. I've got Carla Cassell-Carr with me. She's our chief financial officer and also our federal aid coordinator. And she put up the numbers today for me, and she's got them written down here. Let me give you the numbers. You're going to be getting a check back for us for some additional money here in the not-too-distant future for – you got it, Carla? Sussex County is going to be getting $29,300 from us, and that'll be released here soon from the FY 10 year from July through December. Okay, and what I was thinking in the back of my mind, if you all would escrow that $29,000 into some kind of account and just work off the interest, that'll probably be more than enough to take care of whatever issues you might have with dangerous dogs in the future, or if you can expend it as you want. But there is money there to cover that.
Again, I guess looking at this, you say it's really no big deal, but the degree of detail in this, talking about the number of hours the dogs should be confined, the number of days, the number of years records should be kept, I mean, we're going to be spending over $600,000 on this. Why wouldn't the legislation simply be the county shall create regulations to enforce dog control, period? And then we can use this as a guideline, but right now you're putting a lot of strings on us and very little money.
I understand, Mr. Phillips. I think the thing is it's a statutory issue right now. It's under Title VII, and to delegate it to a situation where it's in with lack of consistency in the different counties, I'm just guessing this, and Mr. Moore maybe can attest to it better than I. I think it was the feeling of they wanted consistency across the board and to transfer the authority as it sets right now, because it seems to be working pretty well.
We call this an unfunded mandate.
Partially funded mandate. Isn't there some funding?
Yeah, you'll be getting funding. You want to realize that right now the collections, I think we're the only state in the country that actually does dog control. I believe I'm correct on that. And most of it's done on a regional or localized level. It's either municipalities or on a county level. Typically in Delaware, I think there's the collections, actual people who are actually paying for dog control or buying licenses, is only about 10% of the total owners out there. They've typically found that if it's localized and it's done on a smaller scale, you usually get an upbeat in the amount of people that participate and actually buy the licenses, and the enforcement step it up to a certain degree. So I'm thinking in the future, you'll have additional revenue coming in. To what degree, I don't know. It depends on the county and how far they push it. You also have the ability to a certain extent, there were some limits put on you of how much you can charge for your tags. That's going to be something that was set by the legislature, and I think the reason being that limit was placed, in fact, was that they were afraid somebody might raise it to an astronomical amount, and they'd have a whole bunch of people really upset. Typically, it was $3, I think it was $3, $6, and $9 for sterilized dogs and $6, $9, $12, and $18 for unsterilized dogs. Now, you all have the flexibility to charge somewhat more than that, so you'll get additional revenue in. Whether it's ever going to carry itself completely remains to be seen. I guess it's going to be entirely up to the county on how they enforce it, how far they push it.
Now, just so I'm clear on this partial funding statement, are we getting something from the state independent of the fines that we collect?
No, all you're going to get from us is the fines. We went through the system as it was set up, after it was structured. Initially, we were paying it all, then it went to a 50-50. As of January 1st, it's incumbent upon the counties to come up with the funding to pay for dog control in their county.
So
it's part of your contract.
There is no separate budget line item from the state giving us partial funding.
No.
It's simply what is collected through the fine and the enforcement.
Exactly, okay. Correct.
Does any other council members have thoughts?
Well, if we have a problem with this legislation, I guess we have to, we work it over, say, for the next year, and we realize there's some, some gray areas or some areas we need to fix. We have to go back and amend the legislation each time, right back up to Dover,
which makes
it a little awkward for, to get something done real quickly.
You can talk to the AG's office and see if there is some way that, as long as the basic guidelines are in place, and if you want to ramp up something in your particular county.
Yeah, I'm following up on Vance, like flexibility. I mean, you've given us the rules, and we've got to follow these rules, and these rules may not be workable in some areas.
I think that it was the wisdom of the legislature to set a benchmark that you all...
Wisdom of the legislature?
Yeah.
It's an oxymoron.
Depends on who you're talking to, Mr. Phillips, but needless to say...
Didn't mean interruption.
It was the wisdom of the legislature to set a benchmark of this is the standard, and you can go above that, but I didn't want to go below that.
I got you. I'm still worried about noisy dogs.
Noisy
How come
dogs.
They're not addressed?
I think that might be something that
I bite my lip
when you said that, but it's like addressing cat control. I mean, it might be one of those areas that you want to think long and hard before you go into, because you'll have a tremendous number of complaints, and I would imagine.
We'll get the complaints because we're in the dog control business now.
And we get complaints too, but what it would do is it'll ramp up the number of complaints that your enforcement or the
KNST. We can't do anything right now. I mean, I'm just saying, when we get
all these
complaints, the
wedge structure right now,
we can't do a thing about a noisy dog.
Noisy dogs, the way I understand it, it's something, it's one of those things.
Nuisance dogs, we could call them that.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's nothing in there
that I think is what most
that I'm aware of. I might be missing something, but I don't think there's anything in there addressing.
I don't think it doesn't look like it.
Barking dogs type of thing, but again, as I said earlier, with the exception of the dangerous dog issue, everything that was in the one bill or proposed bill, you should have had the first go around anyhow. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't really operate a dog control program without having the ability to enforce the dogs running at large. And the other little aspect, one of the big things were when they were only back in here, they didn't, for some unknown reason, didn't give you all the authority to swear in your own officers. And you needed that. And we were still having to have the officers from the animal control officer being sworn in by the state, by the secretary. So we want to make sure you all had that authority to do so. So that's about it in a nutshell. I mean, I can give you more numbers and all that type of thing, and I'm not going to try to dazzle you with all that. I'll give you a little insight, though. Last year, statewide, they sold 20,744 dog licenses. That was for 2009, statewide. There's a heck of a lot of dogs out there that aren't being licensed.
That's only 10% possibly, would you say?
Possibly. From what I gather, because we don't have a firm handle on how many dogs are out there when you don't really, everybody doesn't actually get a license. Right. But we're thinking somewhere in the neighborhood 10, 12% probably.
That number is?
Of dogs, potential dogs that could be licensed. Mm-hmm. There's probably 150,000 to 200,000 dogs out there running around.
Or in houses that never go outside, some of these dogs.
Exactly.
House dogs.
There's a lot of people that don't ever take care of their dogs and keep them inside all the time.
Right.
We had some very insightful commentary during a public hearing when we talked about, I believe, taking over dog control. Would anyone mind if we posted this proposed legislation on our website and maybe those folks could conveniently take a look at it?
Vance,
will we put it back on the agenda, though, then given those people an opportunity, you know, just as a not a public hearing, but some kind of is there another way we can do it?
Well, they can submit comments.
If the public would be invited to.
I'd have no problem with that.
In other words, I would like to, if we're going to do that and we're trying to get public response, let's give them an opportunity, not a public hearing, but maybe just put it on the agenda and public invited to participate. Maybe we could add some wording like that.
Very nice.
Okay.
I appreciate the opportunity coming down here today, and I think if you take time to look at this, it's not as complicated as it might seem right off on its face.
Okay.
So we can go from there. I'll be happy to help you out in any way we possibly can. The reason I was trying to move this as fast as possible is because it's going to have to go through the legislature, and everybody knows what the economic climate is, and I imagine the economy is going to dominate most of the time associated with it as we move further towards July. So, needless to say,
when did they come back? Mid March?
Early March, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. They're doing JFC right now, so they're in the midst of doing that.
They're not even doing that right now. The weather's killing them.
Well, it's been the inclement weather's kind of a problem. I know our hearing comes up this week, but needless to say, be happy to sit down with any of y'all. If you got any questions, feel free to give me a call. If you see your attorney or any of you all see any modifications you think need to be done, or Dave in this, feel free to give us a holler. Again, it's going to have to work with all three counties. It can't very well do it without Sussex or just Sussex alone. So we need to get all three counties buy-in. I've talked to Newcastle County. They had a couple little issues that they wanted to address, and I think we can work that out. It's nothing that we're running big major stumbling blocks. And I've talked to Ken as well, but I haven't heard anything back from him here recently.
Well,
like,
phone number.
Go ahead.
Just a phone number.
Phone number is 739-9910.
We'll likely invite you back when we put it back on the agenda.
Certainly.
If the public has questions, you'll be available.
And the AG's office would have been here today, but the attorney, Bob Phillips, is handling this. He had an accident on a motorcycle or something and broke his leg. So he's still up in Wilmington. He can't even drive. So I told him, I said, you might have to end up coming and get you the next time around. So needless to say, I'll have him down here the next time when you have the meeting. And if he can answer any legal questions that might you all might have.
Mr. President, one of the issues that we would like to have clarified is where the fines go. It appears from reading the statute as is currently drafted, if it's a voluntary assessment, if the people pay up, the money would come to the county, but if it would be actually prosecuted and go to court, then the money would go to the state. And we would like to make sure that that's clarified as to what does happen with the money in it.
You're exactly right, Mr. Moore. I went back through that this morning, and I noticed that error, and I was trying to get a hold of Bob myself this morning to try to clarify that, because in one location he's got it going to the county. It's supposed to all come to the counties, so that's where it's supposed to go. We're not supposed to be getting anything. Mm-hmm. Okay?
Did you bring that check with you today?
No, I didn't bring the check. But Ms. Carla's going to get that to you here soon.
Before your hearing.
Yeah, we'll bring the check down with us. Maybe that'll help things out. Let me sweeten it a little bit, maybe.
I call Pat quite often anyhow, more so I have a bigger problem than that, dogs.
Yeah.
Our biggest problem is deer. So deer does us more harm than dogs do by far.
Well, hopefully, maybe we've got the deer issue kind of to a certain extent addressed. I was talking to Greg Moore this morning about that, and I'm not tying up a bunch of time, but we were talking about complaint, amount of complaints, and I said our complaint level has probably dropped 95% on deer. We don't have the numbers we had once before. I mean, the overall deer numbers are down, but we have the overall complaints are down as well. So I'm hopeful that means that we're helping to resolve the problem, hopefully. I'm not, you never know. Strange things happen sometimes.
I gave up on a lot of my farmland, quit planting. That's one reason, too, I guess. But anyway,
I still have some people complaining. Well, I appreciate that. I certainly do, Mr. Wilson. And we'll do everything we can to help you all out with that issue as well, because I know agriculture, being born and raised here in Sussex County myself, agriculture is very important to the economy, and we want to make sure it's protected as well. So it's a tough balancing act, but we'll get it done.
Appreciate your help in the past.
Thank you very much.
No problem. Thank you.
Anything else, Mr. Baker?
Yes, Mr. Godwin has one item to bring up as a follow-up on our legislative update from last week.
Mr. President, members of council, last week you left me with a couple of questions regarding the legislative update report that I had given to you. First, you asked me to find out Senator McDowell's motivation for this $10,000 amendment, which I have not contacted him yet. I have called. You've seen my emails. I will reach him before they go back in session on March 9th. You also asked me to clarify there's House Bill number 106 would change the disposition of funds for open space recommendations from the Open Space Council to the Parks and Recreation Council. Your question was, are those two councils of the same ilk? And they are. They both act as advisory to DENREC, the Secretary of DENREC. They're both staffed by the legislature or the governor. They're volunteer people from the community that staff these two committees. And essentially, each year, there are interest funds that are appropriated roughly $1 million that's made available to the counties and local governments for park improvements. And this money from the trust, from the Conservation Trust Fund, had always been reviewed and recommended through the Delaware Open Space Council. This bill that we're talking about would move that recommendation to the Parks Recreation Council. And I think your question was, were they two different entities? They're really not. They're under the same blanket of DENREC. And I think your other intention in the question was to find out if the public was losing some ability to direct these dollars, and they are not. Both councils are staffed by volunteers that are appointed by the General Assembly. So that's the answer to that question. You asked me also to clarify the word reasonable in the House Bill number 300. And again, I sent emails to the sponsors and have not received a message back from them yet. So we have one answer out of three on the legislative update. Thanks.
Thank you.
The next item is the administrator's report, and I just have one quick item. And that is the Delaware State Police report for December. During December, the Delaware State Police handled 3,908 complaints in Sussex County. There were 2,395 traffic arrests, 565 felony criminal arrests, and 734 misdemeanor criminal arrests. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Baker? If not, Hal Goblin, our Deputy County Administrator.
Mr. President, members of the council, this morning I have one recommendation for your consideration regarding a wastewater agreement. This is Sussex County Project 81-04 with Bay Forest Club Phase 1.5B, agreement number 913A. In this case, the developer is Mr. Richard Boyle of Gaithersburg, Maryland. The location is the east side of White Necks Road and north of Old Mill Road. This will be part of the Millville expansion of the Bethany Beach Sanitary Sewer District, providing service for 39 single-family lots. The total service connection charges here will be $221,091. We do have approval from our engineering department and from DENREC. We're expecting 35 days of construction, with a construction administration and construction inspection cost totaling $20,352.75, with a proposed construction cost of $135,685. And the supporting motion for this is as follows. Be it moved that based upon the recommendations of the Sussex County Engineering Department for Sussex County Project Number 81-04, Agreement 913-1, that the Sussex County Council execute a construction administration and construction inspection agreement between Sussex County Council and Bay Forest LLC for wastewater facilities to be constructed in Bay Forest Club Phase 1.5B, located in the Millville expansion of the Bethany Beach Sanitary Sewer District.
So moved.
Second. Motion and a second. Any questions on the motion? All in favor say aye.
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 Motion carried. Thank you, Mr. Cobb.
Yes.
Giving you a copy of our most recent fleet report. This report has taken a little longer to put together than I had expected, but one of the reasons for that is because there have been a few improvements made to our fleet as we've gone through this review. We are still delayed on a couple of recommendations, which I'll go over with you as we go through this. First, what I'd like to do is just kind of go through the report and give you a quick highlight of what these pages mean. The first two pages are simply a summary, which I'll come back to after we've gone through the body of the report. Page three shows a financial breakdown or summary, if you will, of our fleet. Understand that the county fleet of automobiles and trucks has never really been viewed or analyzed as a unit before. Each department has done a very good job, however, of managing the cars and trucks entrusted to them for the services that they provide, but we've never really looked at it as a group as to maybe the best way to deal with this fleet as a whole. So I've broken this down on page three into general fund vehicles, wastewater vehicles, and paramedic vehicles, because I believe that the three categories best display the different degrees of service that we're providing to the people of this county through these vehicles. And you'll also notice there's a difference in number of vehicles on the road in each department. The general fund has 96 cars, water and sewer has 113, paramedics operate 37. So our grand total is we're operating 246 automobiles on the highway on a daily basis. Page 4, 5, and 6 are a compilation of miles driven per the general fund. And if we've broken them down. The accounting department has really been over backwards. Gina and Keith Moore have really been over backwards to help me assemble these numbers. This gives us the mileage driven per department per car. And then on page 7, 8, 9, and 10, you'll find this is a computer program coming from water and wastewater. Heather Sheridan manages her automobiles and trucks through the Dossier computer system, which is reflected in these four pages, pages 7 through 10, which over to the far right-hand column, you'll see the miles driven on their vehicles. And on page 10, you'll see a quick equation in the center of the page showing how many miles were driven in total. First of all, I should say the period that we're looking at is July 1st, 2008, through June 30th, 2009. It's that budget year that we're looking at. So all the numbers that we're reviewing are last budget year's
figures. The next page, 11, is again a different program, but a mileage compilation driven on vehicles in the paramedics. There are 37 vehicles that are listed on this spreadsheet showing you how many miles they've driven. So we basically have three different programs there, which they all kind of service the need, but they're not really the same in form. Page 12 is a breakdown of general fund service and gasoline expenses. It's got insurance, fuel, repairs and maintenance, and GPS. This shows dollars spent for service and maintenance on our fleet. Page 13 is paramedics fleet expenses. Now, the paramedics, again, have a different program. They're all doing an adequate job of computing these totals. It's just that we have different platforms we're working on. Now, page 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, and 19 are the pages that really come from, in our accounting office, Louise Thompson. This is her insurance form. Now, I use this form as an audit because I know if a vehicle is insured, we've got to have it somewhere else in the report when I was looking for gasoline expenses and repairs and tires. So this insurance platform I used as the gospel, if you will. Every vehicle that we own is listed on this sheet, even some vehicles that are out of service. Even if it's parked out at the airport waiting to be auctioned, it still is insured, so I knew all those vehicles would be on this list. So the insurance sheets, are the guide, the rule that I used as I put this report together. You'll see on page 19 a total expense of $161,000 for insurance.
Are we insuring vehicles, some of these older vehicles, just for liability, but are we have collision insurance? I mean, what kind of, is somebody actually thinking about the insurance package per vehicle?
Well, yes, they are. The insurance, you can see a breakdown on these pages. I wanted to show you that as well. It gives you the total premium per vehicle. Now, just because a vehicle has been pulled out of service and is parked out at the shop waiting to be auctioned, it still is insured because we still could have some liability exposure until that vehicle is out of our ownership. So it is still fully insured. One of the things we're going to do, and I'll show you this as we go through this report, we're going to shorten up the auction period. We're going to propose to have two auctions a year, and we're going to propose to do them in-house. So we're going to have better control over the auction, and we're going to get them done quicker and on a faster time schedule.
Did I understand you to say that the older vehicles are being fully insured?
Yes.
Well, if you look here, I'm looking on page 3, I guess, of those insurance worksheets.
Mm-hmm.
It does show, Joan, it's like we have some like 1995, 1996, and there's zero collision and comprehensive.
Good.
There is liability.
Good.
But still, we had a 1996 something or other, and we're paying $566 a year on one, two, three, I mean, a bunch of them.
That's a waste.
I think Mr. Baker may have a comment.
Yes, we do insure them for liability, of course,
yeah.
Which is as per state law. And even if they are, as Mr. Godwin noted, even if they're waiting to be disposed of or sold, we still insure them because our employees may use them, so we want to have them covered. And as Mr. Cole mentioned, we do not insure all of them for collision because it doesn't make sense. Just like on a personal policy, it doesn't always make sense to insure them for collision. We do bid this out every 3 years as part of our insurance package.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Godwin, this is an extensive report. Is there any conclusions that you
yes.
have made?
I have some recommendations, yes.
Okay.
It'll only take a minute or two to get through this, the grinding of the minutia. Page number 20, I didn't show individual salaries and benefit packages, but I did take all those into consideration and calculate to a number. What I'm trying to show here is how many of our staff are involved in a chargeable way to managing or operating our fleet. And the people that I have listed here, to the left of their name, we have a percentage. This percentage is a percentage of their time that they and we agree should be chargeable to our fleet. Either they're working on maintaining it, they're keeping records, or they're doing something in a management or a service fashion to the fleet. And there's a dollar figure there as well. Okay. On page 21, in the back of 21, 22, are actually just for your consideration, the fuel man process is a way to purchase fuel out in the field in service stations without paying the motor fuel tax, as we don't, being a government. And it's also a better way to control the purchase, the use of the vehicle, and it'll also do a number of other corrective, I shouldn't use the word corrective. It'll provide a number of services to us that will help us keep a better record of our fuel consumption and miles driven. We already use this system in our paramedic vehicles, and their reports that they gave to me were extremely accurate and extremely professional and very easy to use. One of the things we're going to recommend is that we use this fleet-wide. But I wanted to include this for you to see, because it does offer, I believe, a number of improvements to our motor fuel control systems.
So this would bring uniformity, at least to that aspect?
Yes, to all the fleet.
Okay.
And you know which vehicles are being fueled?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. The way this system works, I don't want to go into too much detail, but the way this system works is there will be a card programmed for each vehicle, and each driver will have a PIN number. So if I drive your car tomorrow, I can, and I need fuel, I take your car out of the glove box, buy fuel, put my PIN number in the pump, and the computer then tells Gina that I bought gas in your car and how much and where. So it's programmed down, and we also put we put controls in the system that suppose the vehicle has an 18-gallon fuel tank, we'll tell the computer not to sell it more than 18 gallons, okay? It also gives you a report that shows you how many times you've purchased, when, how many gallons, your average mile per gallon, which is an important figure, and it'll help us to control to make sure that they're buying the proper fuel, they're not putting fuel in anything else, and if their gas mileage goes from 18 miles per gallon to 6, they filled a gas can, or they did something they shouldn't have done.
The car you can't put that card in and have a different car sitting out there at the gas. You can do that.
You can do that.
So there could be a way to.
But that will show up in that car's performance, because the computer keeps the total control on your car.
Somebody would have to be actually looking at this very.
The department head will have to take a look through each statement as it comes in.
So there's no automatic red flag.
Well, yes, there would be a red flag. In the column, it would show a red flag showing this car got a lot more fuel this month than it did last month. So then you go back and look at all at the purchases, okay? On page 23, I now go into outsourcing services that I'm going to discuss a little bit later, but 23 and 24 show outsourced services. Page 25 and page 26, again, are outsourced services. Now on page 27, I'm giving you a total of outsourced services. These are services that I believe we can do in-house. There are services that we're sending out to shops that I think we can do, provided we need a few pieces of equipment. We have the staff, they have the training, they have the know-how, we have the facility, and in many cases we have the inventory, but we don't have a tire changer, for example. We don't have a tire balancer. So on the following page, page 28, I've provided a list of equipment that I would like to see us acquire that would allow us to do these outsourced services in-house with our staff. And the last page, page 29, is a list of vehicles that we're planning for auction on March 13th. The sheriff is going to sell those vehicles at the EOC parking lot Saturday, March 13th, and that'll be our first. We're going to try to have a sale in March and a sale in September each year, to make sure we have liquidated vehicles that we're not using. I've done a number of comparisons with AAA and with the state and Newcastle County, and I believe that as I've made these comparisons, I think that our fleet is being operated in a pretty cost-effective fashion, but I do believe there are opportunities for improvement, not only in cost, but improvement in efficiency and a little bit of improvement in safety, perhaps. A couple of things that need to be understood. I've made some equations here that relate to cost per mile. And the reason I hang my hat on cost per mile is because in some of our departments, our mileage has actually gone up. our inspectors are now doing all the building inspection for residential properties. So those inspectors are on the road more. And in other cases, I think we may have an argument that some of the mileage has gone down. So while the year that we're in right now will come to an end June 30th, if we're able to put these improvements in place before then, I think next year we'll see a significant decrease in cost, particularly cost per mile. I'm not certain yet what our total miles will be driven, but I do believe that we can improve the efficiency. I want to start off by thanking the staff who worked with me on this. This was quite a project. It took a lot of time, and I was bothering a lot of staff people while they were trying to get their work done, and they were doing special studies and reports for me that it wasn't convenient, but I want to tell you that they were all extremely cooperative, and I found all of them to be extremely knowledgeable about the area in which they were working. So I could ask a question, and I got usually a very quick and a very accurate answer. On the summary sheet on the front of this report, it shows, I'll just briefly go through this, that we operate 246 cars and trucks and pull 55 trailers. Last year, we drove 2,346,000 miles, providing services to the county. The services that we provide include EMS services, deputy services, P&Z inspection, building inspection, assessment inspection, a number of inspections, libraries, even memorable marriages. And this, there was a price tag. For 2,300,000 miles, we spent $1,956.10. That comes out to a cost per mile of just over 42 cents per mile. That's not a bad figure when you look at it that way. The only thing that's not in that cost per mile is depreciation. Our depreciation runs a little over 21 cents a mile. And the reason I didn't include that is because they really can't control that at this point. The depreciation will go down as our number of automobiles goes down. If we have 246 on the road last year, if next year we have 230, our cost is going to go down because we have less depreciation. We operate three repair and service facilities, one at Piney Neck, we have an EMS garage at the airport, and our general main shop at the airport. I wanted to recommend a few upgrades to our system, and I want to also talk about some work that's in progress and probably will be in progress for the next few weeks or months. Some of the things that we picked up in the analysis that have actually helped the operation, we were able to get a demonstration online for Dave Elliott to use at our main garage, which gave him access to Mitchell repair manuals. Mitchell repair manuals are one of the best companies to provide technical information for automotive repair and service with specifications, wiring diagrams, electronics, things of this nature.
For all vehicles.
We got a demonstration, and I knew Dave would like it, and he had had some experience with them before. He was able to fix 12 automobiles that he was not able to fix before, that he fixed in-house. Some of those repair jobs were rather minor, but since he had this information, he was able to make those repairs for us, put those cars back on the road.
How much is that program?
The program is $1,495 for the year. And you have to renew it at the end of the year.
$1,400.
Yeah, $1,495 a year.
Okay.
Right. Now, that demonstration really helped a lot. Mm-hmm. Okay. A couple other things that we've done is Dave Elliott has also been able to reobtain two of his certifications. I'm going to talk a little bit later about job descriptions, but I think that having certified technicians is very important as far as our exposure to liability is concerned. If we're, God forbid, we ever have an accident and someone believes that maybe it was the brakes or one of the components in our vehicle that caused the accident, it's important that we use good parts and we have people who are certified to do the repairs in-house.
Mr. Gobb.
Yes, sir.
I assume you're under on page one, upgrades?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Item B?
Yes.
I would strongly recommend that the first word there needs to be stricken.
Yes, sir.
And changed to require.
Yes, sir.
Not encourage.
I agree with you.
Okay.
I'm glad you made that initiation. One of the things I was going to recommend, Councilman Vinson, is we do not currently have any mechanics in our employ that meet our Mechanic 3 classification. I would like to rewrite the Mechanic 2 and Mechanic 3 job descriptions, and in the Mechanic 3 job description, we will require those certifications. And then we should also make it our policy to have at least one of those in our employ. So I think we can do that, both, and we can do both what you've recommended and also not change anything that's currently happening, but offer an opportunity to upgrade with those requirements. I'll make that change. Thank you. We also are interested in reassigning some routine services from the main shop when overloaded to the EMS shop as work permits. In our EMS shop, they don't do heavy repairs, but they do a really fine job on servicing in a routine fashion our EMS emergency vehicles. I would like to use that model for all the vehicles. It'll do two things. Number one, we won't be changing the oil quite as often. You're going to say, gee, why wouldn't you want to do that? Currently, our general fleet are getting oil change every 3,000 miles. EMS is doing every 5,000 miles. Part of the reason why that's okay is because the EMS driver has a routine. They check certain fluids in the automobiles. They are playing a larger maintenance role, which allows us to extend that oil change period of time. And quite honestly, the manufacturer doesn't recommend it be done any earlier than 5,000 miles anyway. As long as the driver is participating and we're using the proper oil and the proper filters, there should be no problem in extending that, which will save us some money. And if we perform the same service that EMS does to their vehicles, which is more comprehensive as far as inspections and adjustments, we'll actually get a better service process on each vehicle and probably lengthen the life of the car while reducing the cost of maintenance. So that's one area that we're hoping to improve. I would also like to, we've done some reshopping, I'll call it, of equipment and part, not equipment, but parts and supplies. I want to competitive reshop the purchases of our parts, accessories, and tires quarterly, because we've discovered that the state contract is not, I repeat, is not always the best deal. We have found a number of problems with that, and a number of inconsistencies, and we want to reshop this or review this every quarter to make sure we are getting the best deal. We also are recommending a purchase, as I showed you on one of the pages in a report, a list of equipment, $16,035 worth of equipment to enable us to do tire services, fluid flushes, AC recharges, and to perform these services conveniently in-house, which will save us $25,000 the first year the equipment's in place. It's a no-brainer, in my opinion, but that certainly is your decision to permit us to do this. This will not require any new money, as I'm told by Mr. Baker. These dollars are supposed to already be available in a capital fund, I believe, in the EMS department. But in any event, we don't have to adjust the budget or make any changes there. There's a couple of things that led me to this decision. First of all, in last year's budget, the sewer department put a tire changer and a wheel balancer in their budget, and they now mount and balance their own tires at Piney Neck. You might think, well, what's the big deal with that? They're going to buy the tires at state contract, and it can't cost that much to put it on the wheel. Oh, it does. I went through all of our invoices for this budget year, and not only did I find prices all over the scale, the vendors were charging us different prices to mount and balance, but I don't know how many of you have bought tires in the last year or so, but one of our vendors felt free to charge us $23 each for valve stems. This was just a month ago. Luckily, we didn't pay this invoice. Luckily, it was picked up by Eddie Parker, the department head, brought it to me and said, this can't be right. That valve stem should retail for $2. We got billed $23. These are the kinds of service opportunities that we need to deny these folks. We need to get away from this.
A lot of times in the past you're saying we're paying these invoices without really studying.
Well, I don't know that. I don't know that. Right, but I know that as I looked at invoices, I saw prices all over the chart, anywhere from $20 per wheel to mount and balance on a valve stem to $35 a wheel. But there wasn't consistency. I also found, and this is partially our fault, we take a vehicle to a tire dealer for four tires. He will put state contract tires on the car. That's true. But maybe he didn't have the exact tire in stock that was made for that car, So he gave us a little better tire than we really needed. And it really wasn't his fault. He was still living in bounds on the law with the state contract, and we still got a good price on that tire, but we didn't need that tire. We could have made out fine if we'd ordered in advance and gotten the right tire. So that's partially our fault, but I think we can do a little bit better with that. Also, I wanted to talk about computerizing our service records. We have one shop that keeps the records of the cars on a 3x5 card in his file. We have another shop who has a great computer system called the Dossier system, which is what Water and Wastewater uses at Piney Neck. When one of their vehicles gets serviced, their mechanic goes online, pulls up the car, fills in the service. He's got it all computerized. And when I ask them for records, they spit it right out for me because they had it all computerized. The FuelMan system that I recommend we switch to for fueling all of our vehicles also offers a computerized program for recording the service records. We were going to make a strong recommendation to you today that we do this at zero cost, but we haven't gotten a demonstration yet from FuelMan. They were supposed to come 2 weeks ago. This is why I pulled this off the agenda. They were supposed to come 2 or 3 weeks ago and give us a demonstration on this software, and they called and said, our computer folks have told us not to do this today because they're upgrading our program and our software is going to be much better, but we should wait another few weeks until we have all the kinks ironed out of the new system, yada, yada, yada. So I haven't seen the demonstration yet. Once I've gotten the demonstration and everyone else on the fleet committee has had a chance to weigh in on it, we'll then be back to you with a recommendation there. But I firmly believe that it's going to be in our best interest to either use the Dossier system like Water and Wastewater does, Water and Sewer does, or this new system from FuelMan, because then no matter which garage the car is being serviced in, the mechanic will pull up on the computer, the car will have the whole history, and he'll know what needs to be done. And also, at the end of the year, we will be able to get a much better report all in one program so that we can report to you in regard to the service of these vehicles.
Your recommendation is going to be that we're going to fleet-wide use one program.
Well, yes, I hope we can do that. Okay. And there might be some small differences in that. What I'm getting at is Heather Sheridan is extremely committed to the Dossier computer program. She's had much success with it in the sewer department, and she uses it not just for cars and trucks. She also uses it for pumps, for the pump stations. She uses it for all the equipment in the sewer treatment plant. So every piece of equipment that they have, such as backhoes, pumps in the ground, and pumps on the machinery, is all managed through this software package. What I want to suggest is that we either use that through our entire fleet, or if we're going to use the FuelMan system, that eventually we segregate off her equipment that's not on the road into Dossier and put her vehicles on the highway in the FuelMan. She and I haven't made a decision there yet because we haven't seen the demonstration.
Or is there a way she could enter in the new ones. Information, and the information can go to the system she likes, and it could also go to the system we like. Mm-hmm. So
yes,
that we could put the FuelMan.
That's another option. That's another option.
So she could still continue to do her bookwork the way
she's doing. That's another option. I don't want to interrupt the way she's doing it because she's doing a great job. But I also want to be able to get something that works for the whole fleet.
Well, your argument is that the FuelMan services will save us money in all these different areas,
yes,
and we can't just have them out by themselves. I understand that. So
one of the things that I suggested to Heather was, how about when you buy a new truck, we'll put it in the FuelMan system.
Right.
Each time you buy a new vehicle, we'll put it in the FuelMan system, and you keep your Dossier, and then eventually the Dossier will manage your equipment, your off-road equipment.
Well, somebody might be smart enough just to take her Dossier information and shoot it to a FuelMan.
But I don't have that problem solved yet.
Right.
So, but I wanted you to know that we're working on that, and that's
makes
where
sense.
We're going.
Yeah, makes
that's
sense.
Where we're going with that.
Okay.
A question, bookkeeping
yes.
question. Now that we're doing our own inspections, I'm sure that's being charged to that area. Is that correct?
Which inspections?
You said that we have more mileage now because we're doing
yes.
our own.
Yes.
So it's definitely being charged to that department.
Yes.
Okay. Just checking.
Yeah. No. The departments have done an excellent job of managing their mini fleets.
All right,
be
so
they P&Z inspection or the sheriff or wastewater, whoever, they've all taken ownership of their fleet and done a great job. It's just that we have it in fragments.
Does that interface with FuelMan, or does that, or not?
Yes, the FuelMan system will serve for everyone.
Good. Okay.
Thank you. It'll give us the FuelMan system will give us tighter controls. Here's another thing I hadn't even thought about. I had a department head explain this to me. Oh boy, he says, that'll be a big savings. He says, now my guys that never come to Georgetown, who live and work in Dagsboro, won't have to make a trip to Georgetown to get fuel.
Yeah.
And then go back.
Right.
The no-brainer. Of course, you can buy the fuel on site.
Anywhere.
Exactly. Now, I won't spend the time because it does create a little bit of time, but the FuelMan system is going to give us the fuel not just tax-free, we're going to get the fuel cheaper on an average of 8 to 10 cents a gallon less because of how the fuel comes through the system. State contract is a great price, but it includes delivery in small quantities. We have tanks in our garages, and we're buying the gasoline from a jobber or a distributor, if you will, and they're allowed to charge us the state price. The price you're going to see on the invoice, we've already looked at it with FuelMan, because EMS is on FuelMan. It's a significant difference in just the price of the fuel. So we're going to see a savings in the price per unit, regardless of the management improvements.
Hey, Hal.
Yes, sir.
I'm looking this thing over.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not against contracting jobs out. I think we need to be wise how we contract these jobs out.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not so sure that we can do better in taking a lot of these jobs on ourselves, because we're going to have to pay all these benefits on our own employees.
We already are.
I know that. But if we're not busy, then something's wrong here without taking all these extra jobs on. That's what I'm saying here. You say we are. Then I'm looking here, you know, it looks like to me, we go page 27 here.
Mm-hmm.
And we look at, hold a minute.
And we look at service tire. Is these new tires, or what is this deal on this page?
Page 27 is pretty much all the labor for mounting and balancing tires.
Okay,
let me clarify that. First State Chevrolet, $4,800, that's not tire labor. That's mostly brake repairs that we're now doing in-house.
I understand that.
Okay.
All right, number two, service tire.
He bought 52 tires at that location. The $2,600 was mounting, balancing, valve stems, and an occasional wheel alignment, which we're not going to do in-house. But it's mostly all tire labor. Carl King, $1,900, again, is tire labor for 103 tires.
Okay. Now, here's what I've looked at.
Mm-hmm.
52 tires cost us $51 a piece.
Mm-hmm.
We looked at Carl King, it cost us $19 a piece.
Mm-hmm. I told you the price was all over the chart.
If we look at Clarksville, we look at $18 a piece.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like to me the one that's doing the purchasing here is somewhere slipping. And this seems to be the problem. We need somewhere a better purchaser or watching what we're doing here, how we're spending our money. It's not so much that we're going to cut here, but putting this job over on this person or this person. That is such so far fetched between the two prices.
What I didn't explain to you also is the staff time to have two people drive that car down to Garage X, bring him back. Then later in the day, two people go down and pick it up and bring it back. There's probably 3 hours chargeable time on our staff to shuttle the car back and forth for a flat. We can't fix a flat.
I know of two tar places right here local that would be glad to do this and would be more than glad to do it for less than $18 a piece. I know that right
mm-hmm.
now. These prices, we got to look who we're dealing with.
What you need to do, Sam, is go through the invoices with me. Let me show you the invoices, and you'll be astonished.
I look at some of them. I am astonished. I look at our costs because Susan usually hands it down to papers, and I can't look at these. I said, well, that's not the way I would buy.
Now, First Day Chevrolet McGee Motors automatic transmission flush, $2,600. That's a service that we're doing to our EMS response vehicles. We're flushing the transmission fluid every 30,000 miles. I agree we should do that. And $2,600 worth of service is going to be eliminated with a $3,100 machine.
Do you do yours over 30,000?
Yep. On my car, I do.
I don't do mine.
But I drive my car a million miles. So.
I drive mine until it wears out, but I probably
still driving the same car you've had for 40 years.
Right. Well, I've got I got one 40 years old. I don't
now, the bottom right number, IG Burton repairs, $10,000. That's almost all brake work on paramedic response vehicles. we're now.
That's not going to be a total savings, you know. We got oil and everything else in this thing, in this bill, too.
But that $10,000 is now being done in-house. We're not shipping those jobs out at all now.
Sam, what happens also, South Coastal down there, Ocean View, when they need tires, they're not going to drive to Georgetown or something. They'll go to Clarksville. A lot of times they'll go to the closest ones, and there's a list of state contracts. But like he says, it's the marketplace, and the prices are all over the place. By bringing it in, some of this stuff in-house, we've got to see some savings, don't you think?
But if you, being George, you would pick up the phone and says, how much can I buy a tire with a five-year guarantee, so-and-so price?
Right.
You wouldn't just go down and say, well, I'm the
county. Well, that's the private sector.
And some people has an opinion that calls the county, it's the county, we got plenty of money, charge whatever they want to charge.
I know this, if I change my oil at home, I would save money. Sending it out. So if we can, just that theory, if we can just do it here in-house, we should see some savings.
There are a number of things.
I'm not going to say we're not going to have some savings.
But you're talking about a lot of manpower and a lot of just too much oversight to try to keep calling. Some guy could spend all day calling around all these tire dealers to get the best price. And
George, once you establish a dealer that you can deal with is reputable and give you a fair price, you don't have to call them every time.
Al, this is
I do that all the time.
This is a very comprehensive report. I don't believe the council's ready to act on a recommendation. Yeah. I do believe we'll probably want to curl up with this over the next couple of weeks.
Good idea.
It may be wise that we wrap it up now and you be available to answer maybe some of our questions one-on-one.
Sure. Do you want me to stop now? The only thing I had left was the work in progress that we're going to continue with.
Well,
which will take me 5 minutes, but I can
well,
stop
just,
now.
No, I think we've heard. You probably overwhelmed.
I think we have
overwhelmed us.
Yeah, it's starting.
Okay.
And why don't we go ahead and allow us to digest this and expect some
calls.
I think
you're on the right track.
And save me first.
I think what you've got here is more information than I've ever seen in all the years that I've been here.
I think there's an opportunity for significant savings here.
Oh, I do too.
Your background comes into play here.
Very good job.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Gottlieb.
Thank you.
Grant requests. Ms. Jennings.
Okay, we have one grant request today. It's Georgetown Little League for new equipment and uniforms. And Mr. Wilson contributed $500 April of 2009.
I can kick in $100. I pick up some Georgetown.
I'll put the difference in.
Okay. $400 from Mr. Wilson, $100 from me. That'll give him the $500.
Okay.
Could I get a motion to that effect?
So moved.
Second, please.
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you. Introduction of proposed ordinances, Mr. Moore.
There are none, Mr. President.
Wow. We have additional business brought before council. The first is Rod DeFore.
I think he had to leave.
Rod, did you hang in here with us? Rod, we'll be right back. We'll come back to him. Thomas J.
You're on, Rod. Come on down.
We have five folks today. I would share with everyone that we afford you 3 minutes, and if you want to wrap something up, you can have another half a minute, but we'll try to keep things flowing. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your time, folks. We appreciate it. Represent those, I guess you would say I represent the victims of the gambling situation you're trying to get down here. I'm Pastor DeFore, First Baptist in Georgetown, Delaware. 33 years here dealing with this situation more and more. You don't get the true picture of the victims because they're all embarrassed. They won't come out. Just dealt with some last week, and they don't even want to come up because they've been ruined by this thing. Let me just read this to you. I know my time is short for a Baptist preacher to be short. It's hard, you know, amen. Gambling is exploitive and predatory. Will harm our community. Gambling addiction is a huge public health problem, negatively impacting individuals, families, and others. Government primary responsibility is the common good of the health, safety, and well-being of its citizens. We feel that making gambling more available will place an additional preventable burden on our already overburdened government health care, welfare, and criminal justice system. on faith communities and other social welfare organizations which serve many of these needs. Possible financial gain, and I know that's the main game of it. We don't think of the victims, and that's, you know, where we're coming from, the moral issue of this issue. Possible financial gain of any other reason, or any other reason, does not justify legalized gambling in light of the many problems that will develop. We are opposed to any further expansion of gambling, no matter what is the purpose, and are in favor of rolling back gambling in Delaware to end this taxation by exploitation, exploiting people. My mother used to call it blood money, getting money from hurting people. Thank you. Now, let me just read one more thing here to you. This is a quote. Coordinator Tom Gray debated Frank Ferenkoff in Cleveland just before November elections. Ferenkoff is the CEO for American Gambling Association and thus stands as the leading national spokesman for the Commission Commercial Casinos. But would Ferenkoff want one of the products of his own hometown? Here's his comment, quote, "People have the right to go to the ballot box and determine what they want to qualify of life, to be in their own area. Now, if someone were to come along and tell me that they were going to put a casino in McLean, Virginia, where I live, I would probably work very, very hard against it. I just don't. What's the old saying, N-I-M-B-Y, not in my backyard? Now, I may be in favor of gambling, but I just don't want it in my backyard." And that's the leader of the whole mess. I have petitions of 300 or so names here. I'd like to present that to the council. May I?
Give them down to Mr.
Okay, sure. How many would you need, sir, total?
Just give me the one copy that you have.
Well, I have one for each.
Oh, okay, that'd be fine.
Should I give it to them?
Your 3 minutes are up, but if you'd like to conclude.
Yes, okay. Again, we've already given to you folks some time back DVD and information why we're against it. I trust you got it. If you didn't get it, we'll be glad to get that to you. We present it to the secretary sometime back. And so...
thank you very much.
Again, okay. Thank you. Thank you for your time.
Thomas J.
Us.
How you doing? I'd like to thank the council for allowing me to speak today. First, in my opinion, the Del Point project is too ambitious. It's the wrong venue, in the wrong place at the wrong time. Sussex County does not need a casino, nor does it need more retail space. The competition for the local dollar is, as it is right now, is at a maximum. For example, they put a BJ's and Lowe's up in Millsboro, and with the result now, the Ace Hardware has closed up, and the other little places in town are also feeling the impact. Pete Schwarzkopf says the project is shovel-ready. However, Sussex County is not. Besides, I do not see the need for a rush, to rush in blindly. Last fall, I went to the Del Dot open house they had on your little project thing, and Del Dot has no immediate plans for improvement on any east-west road that would allow traffic to flow between US 1 and 113. Some of these improvements now in the planning stages for Sussex County will take 5 years to complete. In addition, none of these projects will expand more than 5 miles from US 1. As for road improvement directly related to Del Point, the only plan they have is for turning lanes and slowdown lanes on 113. The backers for the proposed casino always bring up additional jobs for our county and much-needed revenue for the state. However, little is said for what these jobs will pay and what impact the casinos will have on already overburdened roads and infrastructure. Who will pay for these improvements? We need light industry, more professional complexes. along with well-paying jobs that will inspire our children to stay in school and in Sussex County. And lastly, I'd like to say my father was a gambler. It affected our family in many ways. I remember having to wait for him to return from the horse track before we could have Thanksgiving dinner. I know, I'm sorry, but this is the pastor said, really can do a lot to your gambling. I know he'll do the right thing by voting against the Del Point project. Thank you very much.
Helen Cropper, please.
Good morning. I know my time is limited. Can I hand these out to everyone? I do have copies for everyone. But
if you want to just give them to one, we'll pass them down, save you some time.
Thank you. What I just handed out are factual pieces of information. The top sheet is the aerial photograph of the property for Del Point, and with the artist's rendition. The second page is a copy of the public notice for the change in the roads that was printed in the paper in May. The third page is a copy that DelDOT actually handed out at the June 8th meeting regarding the proposed roads. And that points out the pink stage is stage number one. The blue stage is two. And the green stage is, I don't know. The last page of that is a letter from DelDOT telling me they had approved the roadways as was proposed at the June 8th meeting. Although the traffic impact study was not done until after that June 8th meeting and after the schools were closed. My concerns about the roadways are as follows. Although the current dangerous road conditions exist, stage one only adds to existing hazardous conditions. The developers are not required to address that problem until stage two, and that's the area highlighted in blue. At stage two, there will be a bypass and overpass and all this other stuff. But at stage one, which includes the casino, the racetrack, the convention center, the roads stay as they are with their turnabouts, but all of that traffic from those is deposited at Route 113 and Avenue of Honor as it exists this moment until Phase 2 goes in effect. And no one knows when Phase 2 is going to exist. So we're adding thousands and thousands of people at a road that is already dangerous. Currently, there's a congested stop where Avenue of Honor intersects with Route 13. The intersection allows for only one vehicle to cross the median strip when making a left-hand turn north onto Route 13. In addition, they only allow the vehicle in there has to be small. Any large vehicles are sticking out and danger to oncoming traffic. In addition to that dangerous intersection, traffic exiting and entering the convention center, casino, racetrack, et cetera, as it adds to an already dangerous, Stage one has this elaborate circle system for the complex. However, all the traffic going around the circle is still deposited at the exiting dual highway without changes until stage two. By the way, does anyone have a clue when stage two will be started? How many years will that be after all the additional traffic is created by the racetrack, et cetera? Ask yourself, how anxious are the developers going to be to put out money necessary for the movie theater, sports complex, and an intricate overhead pass roadway system after they have the big money makers? Now I want to address the impact on the youth in our community. I'm not concerned they will lose their lunch money in the slots or their date money sitting at the bar in the complex. I'm concerned about them losing their lives on the roads as a result of the complex itself. Leaving the school, traveling north, there's a dangerous S-curve on Patriots Way. Leaving the school, traveling south on Patriots Way, there is what the locals call Dead Man's Curve. In addition to the curve itself, prior to that curve, there's a dangerous blind Y on the curve where it splits for Bethesda Road and Patriots Way. Those of you not familiar with that road don't have a clue what I'm talking about. Those of you who are familiar with that road, picture this. Hundreds of strangers armed with GPS systems hunting for back roads to avoid all the congestion that has been created by the extra traffic arriving and leaving Dell Point Complex.
Ms. Cropper, could you try to wrap it up?
Yes. I'm going to let that go. Basically, what I have delivered are the facts. You can see the way it's done. And I only have one other comment, and that's that at Stokely Center, as we know it, is no longer. But at Stokely Center, that's a lot of our county facilities are there, our 911 emergency system, and everyone is going to, our veterans cemetery is that way, and now they're going to have to pass the roundabout and go past the casino on their final journey.
And then on top of that, our school system that has, what, over 1,000, 2,000 high school students there?
Yes, and they didn't take that.
They closed down and can't get there?
They didn't do the impact study. Yeah. Until after school was closed. They had not done it as of June 8th, 2008, on the traffic. And the impact study was done after school's closed.
Thank you, Ms. Cropper.
I'm sorry, 2009.
Thank you. Mandy from Lewis. Mandy Oluweiler?
Oluweiler.
Yeah, good.
Thank you all. DFPC opposes all forms of legalized gambling for both moral and pragmatic reasons.
More to one of those microphones, it might be. Yeah.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
And yep. Who is the organization you referenced?
Delaware Family Policy Council, known as DFPC, was established in 2007 as a statewide organization that specializes in analyzing how proposed and present public policies impact the health of Delaware's families. We believe that strong families are unrivaled in directly impacting our most challenging social ills. We believe that if lawmakers are truly for the family, they will lead by strength, by ideal, and the overall good, and do whatever possible to elevate the family unit, because we know that when families are strong, every aspect of society is strong. Therefore, DFPC opposes all forms of legalized gambling or expansion of gambling for both moral and pragmatic reasons. We believe the net societal effect of our state's embrace of gambling will be disastrous. The facts support this on a national level, and we believe this to be the case in Delaware, as gambling is viewed as a means to handling our state's budget shortfalls and fiscal challenges. Gambling is driven by and rooted in greed. For this reason, the activity is morally bankrupt from its very foundation. Gambling is also an activity which exploits the vulnerable, the young, the old, and those susceptible to addictive behaviors. Legalized gambling breeds a host of social ills, as has been demonstrated time and time again in areas where gambling has been introduced on a widespread basis. Legalized gambling creates gambling addicts. An abundance of research and expert testimony demonstrates that as gambling expands, so does the number of those with serious gambling problems. Millions more Americans have developed devastating gambling addictions over the last few years as a direct result of gambling's rapid proliferation. Further, these newly created addicts are the lifeblood of the industry. Preliminary research indicates that a third or more of gambling revenues come from problem and pathological gamblers. Gambling is an economic negative. Many states and communities embrace gambling as a means to generate additional revenues as well as to inspire economic growth, boost tourism, and create jobs. Gambling's ability to do all of these is greatly exaggerated or non-existent. For instance, gambling often hurts, not helps, existing businesses by siphoning away discretionary dollars that might otherwise have been spent at local shops. The supporters of the Dell Point Project, for example, think they can lure gamblers to the resort by offering family-type attractions. This idea goes against the very nature that drives someone to a casino, and it didn't work in Las Vegas either. One can easily imagine situations where parents will leave their kids at large, quote, in the resort, unquote, while they take one more chance or have one more drink. Also, the social costs associated with gambling, such as losses due to crime, additional law enforcement, costs, gambling addiction treatment costs, and lost work productivity are staggering, often far exceeding a state or community's total revenues from gambling. Legalized gambling devastates families. Authorities in gambling jurisdictions report dramatic increases in divorce, suicide, bankruptcy, and child abuse and domestic violence related to gambling. Research shows that children of gambling addicts experience lower levels of mental health and physical well-being. Given these and other considerations, it is unconscionable that our government would continue to allow and even promote gambling activities. Legalized gambling is ravaging the lives of untold thousands of individuals and families throughout the nation and contributes substantially to the moral decay of our communities. Therefore, we believe legalized gambling in all its forms should and most vigorously be opposed. We're asking you as council members to vote yes on the resolution. Your yes vote will communicate that you lead by strength and not by the weaknesses of our humanity. We will never have long-term gain when policy is based on weaknesses as its foundation. Your yes vote communicates that you believe there is a better way to bring jobs into our county and state, and it's not by short-term gain that sacrifices our families.
Thank you. Eric Bodenwasser.
Good morning. Recently, Representative Pete Schwarzkopf was a guest on the WGMD radio station. Representative Schwarzkopf was doing his best to bring favor to the Del Point Casino. He said, and I quote, "We need jobs in this county, and people need to get back to work." So in Representative Schwarzkopf's opinion, we should allow gambling into our county to cure unemployment and fix the state's revenue problem. He has no regard for the long-term welfare of the citizens of Sussex County, only for the short-term welfare of the state budget. One man called in about his gambling-addicted father and how he lived in an extremely poor childhood due to it. Representative Schwarzkopf fired back that his stepfather was an alcoholic and that he was stronger because of it, and the caller was probably stronger also. Apparently, the representative's newest government program, the expansion of gambling into Sussex County, includes ruining parents' lives in order that their children will become stronger from the experience. There is no way of calculating the amount of crime in the form of unreported domestic violence that occurs due to gambling addiction. Neither are we able to calculate the marriages that will result in divorce or fortunes that are lost or lives that end in suicide. All we ever hear about are the few people that win. Representative Schwarzkopf also admitted that the Del Point developers had knowingly circumvented the county council's approval process by going directly to Millsboro for annexation because they realized they did not stand much of a chance getting it passed by this council. Considering this resolution allows you the opportunity to weigh in on this project. On September 22, 2009, the Indian River School Board passed a resolution against casinos being built near their schools. Last month, Senator Colin Bonini and Representative Dave Wilson distributed copies of the school board's resolution to all 62 members of the state legislature. Representative Schwarzkopf is close to passing his bill in the House. At last count, it seems he has 18 of the 21 votes he needs to pass it. I strongly believe that a resolution from this council will have a resounding effect on the legislators in Dover that are still on the fence about this issue. Please do what you can to stop the expansion of gambling into Sussex County. Please consider putting this item on your agenda for consideration. Please pass the resolution against building casinos in our county. Thank you.
Thank you. Council have anything additionally? Mr. Cole?
Well, I just would like to comment to these, their concerns. County Council, we are primarily in the land use business, and when it comes to social issues and social programs, the state of Delaware has exclusive power in those areas. A couple weeks ago, I brought up that, you know, we ought to look at putting gambling facilities in a separate zoning category so we can address them. And I mean, that's where we have the power to really affect things. And I think there was a consensus to have our staff look into it. So we are looking, hopefully, and the staff is pursuing this, to have a separate exclusive zoning category. Right now, they could be put in a commercial district, right? If it had commercial zoning, there's nothing, anything special. So I think we can move that area, and that's where we can have an impact. Individually, I don't have any problem with county council taking a position on gambling. I don't know if as a body, similar to the school board. The school board, I don't think, really said we're against gambling. They just said we didn't want it near our school. I think county council should, because land use is our area of concern, where we have the clout, we ought to stick to land use solutions. And I think a solution would be to have a separate category for those facilities. Now then, they will circumvent the county council and go to the towns. We can't control that. We could maybe oppose annexations, and we do have the ability to oppose annexations, correct, Everett? If they came up. I believe this one's already been annexed, right? And we did not oppose it. And historically, we've never opposed, obviously, annexations. But anyway, that's my personal approach to how county council can be directed at this issue. And we would have the public hearings. We could take all this into consideration, but as a land use issue, because that's what we do. We're not in social programs, and I agree with you. I've never been to Harrington. I've never been to any of them. And I know they're starting a facility in Ocean City with gambling. There's not enough gamblers around. Actually, the numbers are down because when the economy's bad, people don't go to these places. And yet they're still pushing for it. And under the guise of good jobs, and I think it just shows you how desperate the state of Delaware is to try to get revenue, that they're going to go, you know, put all their eggs in this one basket. And I find that I'm disappointed in that. I think there ought to be other solutions. But I'm not in Dover. I'm in Georgetown. So that's just my take on it. But we are trying to do something, and hopefully our staff will have something here in the near future so we can address these.
Any other council members before we?
First of all, I'd like to thank each one of you for taking your time to come and share your thoughts with us. It's a rarity to find people that stand for morals today, really. Most people are worrying more about their pocketbooks, don't give a hoot what the victims pay, what our children has to pay. They don't even really care about the way into this school. We just built this new school a few years ago. The school boards took time now to vote against it because they know the dangers that this is going to bring to those kids. They don't care if they close the road. You get to the school the best way you can. It's important that we get gambling. And to me, I think that we're not really looking this whole picture when we put gambling ahead of our own children. It always should be children first. That's what it's about, children first, we always say. But no, it's come gambling first. It's our budget first. It's wasting money first. But to me, it's very critical, important that we look that we're closing off a road, a main access to our high school, and don't give a hoot how they get down there, don't care the dangers in it. So I feel, as a councilman, I feel we should vote no. If it doesn't say anything, but just say we don't approve of it, as same as the school board did. The school board could not stop it, but they did let them know they did not approve it. And I feel that we're in the same position. We should take it and say, we don't approve. If you've got a better way of coming in, you want to fly in a helicopter, come around the back way, but you should not be allowed to block these highways to these schools and make a more dangerous way of getting to a high school.
Any other council members before we...
Can I follow up on Sam's point there? Vacating roads, Everett, we can have the ability to request DLDOT to have hearings on them. We can also have input because that is a land use issue. So when it comes to that vacating road issue, Sam, I think the county council can take a stand on that.
There is actually a state law procedure for vacating roads, which does involve notice to the public as well as adjacent landowners.
And you can request a public hearing. Right. Sometimes if there's no request, then they'll just approve it over the table, I think. We can't have an impact there. Right. Okay, thank you.
I will entertain a motion to recess until 1:30. Second, please.
Second.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.